a sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 7, 1996, entitled, Look Again, Star Trek. The scripture readings for the sermon are Genesis 1, verses 1 through 5, Ephesians 3, verses 1 through 15, Psalm 98, and Matthew 2, verses 1 through 18. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 1, verse 3, Ephesians 3, verse 9, and Matthew 2, verse 2. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Here we go. Star Trek. I took the title, of course, from that movie series, Star Trek. I hate to admit it to you, but I hadn't seen one of that whole series. That's how out of it I am in terms of contemporary culture. But I did rent one from Blockbuster in order to make sure there wasn't something in Star Trek that would make it improper for me to use the title. And I found that the trek about which I was talking about was an overland trek, torturous in its demands, while Star Trek, the movie series, speaks about the exploration of outer space, of course. But it is Epiphany, the day after the Feast of Epiphany, and I awoke this morning to an Epiphany experience. As is my custom, arising at 5 and finally finding my way up into my loft, I looked out across the waters. There was a full moon hanging over the lake. And as it usually does on such occasions, there was that marvelous path of silver making its way toward the shore. But this time, there was something different about it. There was a kind of luminousness about it, which seemed to be broken with dancing light. And trying to figure it out in the darkness with just that illumination, I took my binoculars and realized that the ice fields had moved in toward the shore, so that the moonlight was radiating off that ice mass, giving a kind of translucence to the surface. It was a very gentle undulation in the water, not enough to break a wave, but just enough to keep that body moving so that the ice flow would be broken. And where the ice would be pushed back, there the open water would expose itself to the silver of the moon, and the light would dance and sparkle. And it was as though there were great searchlights on the bottom of the sea shining up. It was an absolutely marvelous epiphany moment. And I watched, and I wondered, and I worshiped. And if you had all been there, we could have been silent for a time, and I would have pronounced the benediction, and we could have gone home. For an epiphany moment like that is enough for anyone on any day. Simply a moment to experience one's unity with all things, one's inclusion in the vast and grand cosmic scheme of things. To have a moment of awareness, of attention, a moment of wonder and awe that issues in worship, it is enough for anyone, for any day. And so I've had my epiphany moment for the day. And I wish you could have shared it with me. I love this season of the year, the season of Epiphany, the season that reminds us that the whole human story is laced with light, with moments of breakthrough, moments of revelation, moments when the landscape of the mind is illumined, the mind or a community or a society, sometimes the whole world, bathed in light, at least for a moment. And we know that we are at one and at home. Epiphany is a season of manifestation. It is the celebration in the church of the fact that the light has come, that the one who in the beginning spoke and said, "Let there be," and caused light to shine, dispersing the darkness, continues to shine and to illumine our hearts and our minds, and to invite us to wonder, to engage in a journey of discovery, and finally to worship. The season of Epiphany is celebrated after the 6th of January, the feast day itself, which comes on the heels of the 12 days of Christmas. That was an early compromise in the ancient church. In the East, they celebrated the 6th of January, as Orthodox Christians still do today, on the 6th of January. It was the day of the Festival of Lights in ancient Egypt, and they borrowed it for the celebration of the coming of light in the Christ child. But then, after some centuries, when Constantine converted, the Emperor of Rome converted to Christianity, through a lot of maneuvers and inner conflict, intramural conflict, he established December 25, which was the Roman date for the winter solstice. And so, as kind of a compromise, the church has celebrated all these centuries the birth of Christ on December 25th and the visit of the Magi on January 6th, embracing the 12 days of Christmas. Actually, it doesn't make any difference, for those dates are as good as any, and they're certainly not the dates they claim to be. But we know by now, in our celebration of the great festivals of the church, that they are simply the convenient hooks that we can hang our thoughts on. They are those moments that punctuate the year, that enable us to celebrate and to remember. And I enjoy the Christian year because it calls me back annually to some of the great universal themes and forces me to think with you about those great central ideas that have shaped us and formed us as a people. So the season of Epiphany gives us occasion to celebrate the coming of the light, the presence of the light, and reminds us that the coming of the light is a gift, that all truth, all awareness of truth and insight is finally a gift that comes to us. We don't conjure it up within ourselves. It dawns upon us. It is gift. It invites us to wonder and to worship. And in this season of the year, we celebrate the fact that the light has dawned, that the deepest truth of things has been manifested to us. Indeed, we celebrate the fact that God has been enfleshed in humankind, in one like us. In humankind, this cosmic scheme has become conscious of itself, aware of itself, and even drawn to worship and to adoration. So the story of the Magi is the natural, traditional story that celebrates that following of a star, that journey of discovery, that arrival at the posture of worship and adoration. And in this Epiphany season, 1996, I want us to look again at some of the old familiar stories that we know so well. Because around here we're fond of speaking of Epiphany eyes, the eyes with which one sees that which is always there, so familiar that we don't see it anymore. Epiphany eyes that enable us to see something fresh and new in the old and the familiar. Matthew tells us the story of the Magi, and it's interesting how the church has used this story down through the centuries. It is claimed that in the coming of the Magi we have the first wave of the Gentiles who came to the truth that was revealed in Jesus Christ. The church has gone on to say not only that that truth was in Jesus Christ, but that the only truth was in Jesus Christ. And the celebration of this season has often been for the church a time to lift high its claim to absolute truth. But on Epiphany 96, let's look at it once again. What was Matthew really telling us about the coming of these visitors from the ancient East? Well, as a matter of fact, there probably was such a visit. There probably were individuals, whether there were 2 or 3 or 16. The Magi were a class of people in the ancient East who studied the stars. They were philosopher types, sages, if you will. They lived in contemplation. It's really amazing in the ancient world how much they had come to know about the planets and the stars and the movement of heavenly bodies. It's amazing, without the technology that we have, how much they had come to learn about the movement of the heavenly spheres. And they studied and contemplated that movement because they believed somehow in scanning the stars they would find some clue to human destiny. They didn't know what we know, that we really are the children of stars, star stuff, all of us. But they were starstruck nonetheless, because they realized somehow that they were woven into a fabric of being that found manifestation in the starry heavens. And so maybe, well, I wonder if it could have been that one of them had an experience like I had this morning, not with a silvery moon over a frozen lake, but maybe a brilliant explosion of a star in the eastern sky. And to them, that signaled the birth of someone great. And their journey as they set off to follow the star was reflective of the deep yearning of the human soul to penetrate the mystery of things. The deep yearning in the human soul to find that one finally that will bring liberation and freedom and peace to earth. Matthew tells us the story, however, not to indicate some sign that now the nations are going to flow to the manger. I think rather, if we read Matthew in context, he was warning us as he begins to tell the story of Jesus that the coming of light brings with it not only promise, but also potential pain. I think Matthew was telling us the story of the coming of the Magi to alert us to the fact that we may celebrate the light, But we may not like at all what the light exposes and reveals. I think that the gospel story that we have domesticated, that we have made so sweet and sugary at Christmas time, is a very rough and tough story of the coming into the human story of a light that exposes it for what it is. For the Magi very naturally made their way to the court in Jerusalem. They came to one named Herod, one of the most ruthless, brutal, violent men ever to sit on a throne. They came there inquiring about the potential birth of a world savior. Naturally, they would go there. But in going there, they went to one of the most paranoid individuals who had ever lived, one who had his own sons killed in order to wipe out the possibility of any pretension to the throne, one who had become Rome's lackey in Jerusalem, one who, with his obsequious behavior over against Roman imperial authorities, had secured his position in Jerusalem at the expense of his own people, one who was an illegitimate king and therefore spent his whole life and all of his energy trying to protect and preserve his position. It was to that court that the Magi came. It was there they inquired about a birth, and the very inquiry itself set off this paranoid tyrant, to the extent to which Matthew goes on to tell us, when he realized that these Magi would not return with the information about the discovery of the birth of a child, simply had all children 2 years old and under slaughter. Matthew tells us that this marvelous coming of light in the world is a coming of light that is resisted. It is a light that exposes. It is a light that we celebrate and often fail in our naivete to see that it is a light before which we stand naked with all of our human failings and flaws, a light that would invite us on a journey of discovery and ultimately to wonder and to worship, but a light that in the first place will expose us for who we really are and all of the corruptions of power and greed and selfishness that have marred and marked the human story to the present moment. Matthew tells us that the coming of light can bring pain as well as possibility. The old American philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson says that God gives to everyone the choice of truth or repose. And one may choose as one will, but one cannot have both. And it is true. Truth or repose, but you can't have it both ways. And the real focus of Epiphany is that the light has come and the truth dawns, and the invitation is to go on a journey of discovery and growth and transformation and ultimately to worship. But the human story is one of obstruction and resistance and denial, because the light holds potential pain if we would look honestly in its full glare. It's an amazing thing about the human story. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about structures of government or economics or religion, the church, seems that it's always the same. There's the epiphany moment. There's the dawning of light. There's the breaking forth of luminosity. And someone sees it and shares it. And a community heeds it. And a movement starts in all of the freshness of seeing with new eyes. Until before very long, that which was new and fresh becomes old and stale and perpetuated by domination and preserved by force. Amazing thing, isn't it? If we don't take any broader look than just the story of the Christian church, if we'd really take the theme of Epiphany, wouldn't it be that light has dawned on the world? Wouldn't the coming of the Magi be an indication that there is a universal human hunger that seeks to wonder and to worship? But before very long, the growth of the church, the conversion of a Roman emperor, the church in its structure was into domination and authoritarian forms just as much as Rome in its imperial form ever dreamed of being. And so the church, rather than celebrating the light, claims it alone has the light. Did you hear the epistle reading this morning? Paul knocked off his horse by the light. He sees something. The scales fall off his eyes. He becomes as passionate for this new truth as he was for persecuting the old way. He writes to the people at Ephesus. He says, I've seen the mystery. I've discovered the secret hid for ages, but now an open secret, the unveiling. Don't you see it? There's no longer Jew and Greek. In another place, no longer Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, for Paul saw something in this coming of Jesus, in this life of Jesus, this one who had table fellowship with all sorts and conditions of humankind. Paul saw that every division that separated people was false, that all barriers were removed, that there was a kind of universal coming together. He said, don't you see it? The light has come. Before very long, Paul and Matthew and the whole drama of the dawning of light that invites to a journey of discovery ongoing, to wonder and to worship, becomes shut down and closed down to where we have a certain deposit of truth that is supposedly passed through history untouched by all of the shaping of the cultures around it. You see, Emerson was right. One has to choose whether one will be a seeker after truth or will choose repose, which means rest without searching, living without feeling, acting without thinking. Edith Hamilton, who has done work in the traditional myths of ancient Greece, writes that when the world is in a storm, people flee to those old citadels of faith. And don't we see it in our world today, when it seems that the foundations are shaking and There seems to be such a flight to absolutisms and to old dogmatisms, whether it be in government or economic theory or the institutions of the church. This lust for certitude, this fleeing for safety, this refusal to allow the light to continue to illumine the path into the future. Thomas Berry, who may be our contemporary magi, our contemporary philosopher, a historian of culture, says that in our society today, we're a society between stories. There was a day, and many of us grew up in a day, when we knew who we were and we knew what the story was and we knew how we fit in. But we live in such a rapidly changing context today when it seems like nothing is the same and nothing is solid and stable. Everything seems to be in flux. Even the cosmologists are talking about chaos theory. There is an order, they say, in chaos, but it appears to the human observer as pure chaos. And we don't live with chaos very well. And so, Thomas Berry says, the old story doesn't work anymore. Now there are hordes and hordes of people that are fleeing back to the old story, shouting louder the old story, hammering ever more fervently at the door of the old story, but it won't work anymore. If your eyes are open, it won't work anymore. Thomas Berry says the new story hasn't yet gelled. And so we live between the stories. We live at a hinge point in human history. And that's a scary time for folks. Particularly when pulpits across the land talk about the imminent decay of the whole fabric of society. Well, let me suggest to you at Epiphany 1996 that we look again and that we see the time between the stories as a marvelous time of opportunity. Because of the stubbornness and the obstreperousness of the human animal, it seems as though things have to fall apart completely before we're open to anything that's new. It seems as though rather than methodically dismantling and making room for the new, we have to have the old crumble around us and be standing there naked and bare before all of the forces of the cosmos. But the time between the times is a wonderful time, a fertile time, a pregnant time, a time when the new is waiting to be born. And what a marvelous day in which to live, our day. What a time to be alive. What a time to be a part of the cosmic scheme of things. With all of the possibilities out there before us, you see, the coming of the light brings pain for those who would shut themselves off against the light. It brings anguish to those who want to restore the old or rebuild old ways that are no longer possible. But to those who have the spirit of the Magi, who've seen a star, who have the courage to engage in the journey, to those who would have their lives be a constant Star Trek, to such, the future is golden with the promises of the God who comes to us, the one who in the beginning said, "Let there be light," and to whose light we move, that light eternal. In the meantime, to be alive, to be fully alive, to be aware, to be conscious, to live fully this moment, to be engaged with others in this ongoing human story. What a season, what a time, what an invitation to live, to wonder, to wander, and to worship. Thank God, the light has come.